the International Connection. This is week number 16 in a radio series on mind control, and to summarize what we've heard so far, we've heard several shows laying the foundation of the documented reality of U.S. and Canadian government-sponsored mind control. We've also heard the accounts of some survivors, such as Claudia Mullen, Chris Ebner, and Ronald Howard Cohen. Claudia Mullen is alleging that CIA doctors such as Martin Orn, Sidney Gottlieb, and L. Wilson Green experimented on her in childhood using drugs, hypnosis, sleep, and sensory deprivation, radiation, and physical, emotional, and sexual abuse. Claudia is also alleging that Canadian doctor Ewan Cameron from McGill University in Montreal was involved in the mind control experiments on children as an electroshock consultant to the CIA, shocking the child victims after experiments or operations to make them forget. Claudia has also told us of being used as a mind control sex slave for the U.S. government, being set up in sex situations as a child with military brass, politicians, and other officials while the CIA videotaped them for blackmail and coercion purposes. We've heard the historic testimony of mind control experiments at the presidential hearings on radiation experiments in 1995. The final report of that hearings included recommendations to declassify all information related to the mind control experimental programs. Today, we are going to hear a presentation by Valerie Wolf, given at the Believe the Children conference in April of 97, entitled Assessment and Treatment of Survivors of Sadistic Abuse. Valerie Wolf is a therapist of Claudia Mullen, both of whom gave testimony of CIA mind control at the radiation hearings. In this presentation, Valerie talks about her approaches in helping to heal mind control survivors and the techniques used by the CIA to control their victims. This program, which continues next week, is of particular interest to the therapy community that are dealing with survivors of mind control, ritual abuse, and trauma. And just to explain a term that Valerie uses at the beginning of this, she refers to EMDR, and that means eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, which is one therapy technique. You're listening to CKLN 88.1, and now, Valerie Wolf.
I am going to talk today about treatment of mind control. I'm going to start with grounding us in good therapy practice in terms of the model of treatment, which is now called stage-oriented trauma treatment, which is becoming the standard of practice for trauma therapists, because the way that I work with mind control, I think, is different from some of the approaches that I've been hearing about, because when I first heard about this in June of 92 and started working with it in September of 92, I essentially worked in isolation, totally by myself. I had nobody to talk to except my clients until I testified in, or we testified in Washington in March of 95, and then the world opened up. But up until that point, I had worked pretty much alone with mind control and a lot of with the SRA clients. So I sort of developed it out of what I knew, which is the therapy model. And I have spent the last couple of years trying to figure out what it is that I was doing, because what I'm finding is my clients are getting better. I have several clients that are through the process, and all of my other clients are just absolutely phenomenally better. I've also been providing consultation for some therapists, brief consultations for some therapists in Louisiana and across the country, and when they apply the kinds of things that I'm going to tell you today, they have the same kind of success with this extremely difficult population. So we're going to start with assessment, and I'm going to talk about assessment in terms of mind control, and that's an ongoing process. Always you're making assessments about what's going on with your clients. And then second stage, safety and stabilization, and this is really 80% of the treatment. Then trauma metabolism, which is the memory work, and trauma resolution. And then when I get finished with this, I will go back and talk specifically about treatment of mind control and how I conceptualize it in a way that makes treatment effective. Okay, in the assessment, you do standard intake procedures. You want to know what is the thing that brought the client into treatment. Recently, I did a consultation for a psychiatrist, and a woman came in to my office, and I was asking her what it was, why she was coming. And the psychiatrist wanted me to use EMDR because I am trained in doing EMDR. You cannot use EMDR very well with mind control clients. And she said because she had a fear of doctors and going to doctors' offices. I pursued that a little bit, and we got into talking about some of the things that doctors did. She had some memories of doctors hurting her, and as I began to inquire more and more, this woman turned out to have mind control. One of the things you want to look at are current symptoms and functioning, and that's really important in terms of any kind of sex abuse. You know, most of the clients come in with depression or anxiety or some kind of behavior, suicidal symptoms. One of the primary things I look at when clients come in are their primary relationships, because I know that however a client has related to parents or significant others in their lives, that's how they're going to relate to me. That's a real clue. Also, if there was a nurturing person somewhere in their background, because one of the things I'm assessing for all the time, and understand that I get really difficult people referred to me. I have always ended up with clients that no one else wanted to treat, which is, I guess, how I kind of stumbled into this area. But I know if I explore previous relationships with other therapists, I'm not so arrogant as to think I'm going to do any better. I know the same things are going to come up with me. And I'm prepared for it. The other thing I look for is the ability to attach. And this is so important with all of this client population, and that's beginning to come out in the literature, because if you are going to be involved in a prolonged, deep therapy relationship, and if people are going to be able to sustain the kinds of work that they're going to have to do, they have to have the ability to attach. And I have to feel the attachment as well. And that is the thing, the connection that sustains the therapeutic relationship through a lot of really, really difficult work. And I have had clients who are unable to attach, and basically what I have done is referred them on to other therapists. But that is a very, very important thing. And what you find is a lot of these clients can, for whatever reason, even though they've had horrible abuse throughout their lives and cannot identify anybody in their background, there is a drive with children to attach to people. And sometimes even the attachment to the perpetrator, even though they would get abused, even the attachment to the perpetrator can serve a positive thing. Because if you can attach, it makes things easier in terms of jobs, making relationships with people. And so I'm really emphasizing that because I've found that is probably the single best predictor of good outcome in therapy. Is that ability to attach. Forming the therapeutic alliance. Want to look at addiction issues, and I'm going to do this real quick because what I'm giving you is a workshop that I did in 7 hours 2 weeks ago. Addiction, victimization as adults, because we know that when people have been sexually abused and abused as children, and if there's this severe sadistic ritual abuse or mind control, that they tend to be re-victimized as adults. You don't often get told about that, so you need to inquire about it. Ask them if they are crime victims. That's not something that we standard ask people. But that also is important because that's another part of victimization. In fact, some of my clients say that what has happened to them is a crime and they are crime victims, which is true. Any other trauma that has happened, like death, divorce, and how they manage those, because that also gives you a clue as to how the therapy is going to go, whether they have committed crimes, because sometimes, and again, this is ongoing, but sometimes what I have found is that some of my clients who come in identified as victims have, in fact, perpetrated with children that they have babysat in adolescence, or they've done shoplifting, or they've done other things. And that's a source of deep shame. And you really want to know about those things at some point in the therapy in order to help them work through that. Their legal history. And unfortunately, in this day and age, we have to be aware of lawsuits. whether they have a current lawsuit, whether they have a previous lawsuit. And this isn't just lawsuits against therapists, but any kind of lawsuit, like for an accident or whatever, because the litigation process produces certain kinds of effects. And if they ever decide themselves, and the therapist should never suggest a lawsuit, but if they ever decide to go through one, sometimes their experience with a previous lawsuit will determine that. Or they may have access to the information, and it's important for you to know and to document if they've been through a lawsuit before. If there's suicidal ideation, self-mutilation, self-destructive behavior, a lot of this is hidden. People, if they're cutting, will cut on the inside of their thighs or parts of their body that you can't see. In fact, how I started really treating mind control specifically is I had a client who had carved an upside-down cross in her chest. And it was like she had all the earmarks of what I had been told about, and I went, well, I guess I better try this, because she was headed for the hospital. Self-destructive behavior. One of the ways that you can pick up on and begin to think if you have a mind control victim or a sadistic ritual abuse victim or survivor is that if you get I have to die, I have to die, I have to die, compulsive behaviors, compulsive thoughts of suicide, compulsive thoughts of self-destruction, and on the other hand, they are lucidly saying to you, I don't understand why I'm thinking this because I really don't want to die. I don't understand why I'm doing these behaviors, but it's like something comes over me and I just have to follow through with it. When I hear that kind of compulsion kinds of stuff, then I begin thinking about maybe that's what we have here. You want to look at their current support system. And this is really important. Because if they have a current support system, then that means there is not going to be so much pressure on me, the therapist, to provide that support system. Because what I want to do is to have another set of either friends, spouse, somebody who's out there so that everything isn't dependent on me in therapy. Unfortunately, one of the things that happens is that as people get better in therapy, they realize, and this is a real loss issue, they realized that many of their friends were picked out of their dysfunction. In fact, I have a client that's going through that right now, and she has basically dropped all of her friends that she thought were really good friends because the kinds of relationships that she had were she was the helper, always doing stuff, always at her friend's beck and call, and they were extremely narcissistic and demanding. And now that she's healthier, and she's a mind control victim, and now that she's healthier and she can see this, she's extremely lonely and she's beginning to build new and healthier relationships. So even the best laid plans in terms of building a support system don't always endure. So you need to be aware that that's going to happen sometime down the road. Knowledge of memory and trauma. You want to ask, what do they know? And if someone's coming in with memories or at the point at which they start remembering things or revealing to you that they were abused, you want to find out and document what have they heard in the media, what have they read, what do they know, who have they talked to, and document this. And you want to know what their impressions are about memory and their information. And this is really important because if people are reading books and whatever, doesn't necessarily mean that's causing the memory. It could be triggering memories, but you also want to begin to develop a list of triggers. So not only for protection in terms of educating them about memory work and memories and what goes on in therapy, but also because you want to begin to identify triggers. And there are a lot of triggers in the media. And it's really important for you to begin to take note of that. And then you ask, is there anything else significant in your life that you want me to know? And this is a question we sometimes don't ask. I mean, I remember a very long time ago, I had a woman in therapy. She was a survivor. And we got to the end of therapy. And the very last session was planned. And all of a sudden, in the session, she reveals to me that she'd had an abortion when she was 19. And I'm sitting there thinking, what do I do now? She went into an intense ab reaction of the event. And so what I did is I reframed it into, thank you so much, what a gift that you have shared this with me. And she informed me, that's all I needed to do. I just needed to tell you, I needed to remember, I'm fine with it now. And she really was. But I have now started asking for that information a little bit earlier, more for my comfort, so that I don't get surprised at the end of therapy with something. But there may be things that they're not telling you. And again, this is an ongoing thing, all these kinds of questions, always thinking about. Another part of the assessment is if you're assessing, are you starting getting the compulsive kinds of ideation, you're starting to get the message kinds of stuff, you want to assess also the kinds of things that they're telling you as a therapist. One of my clients that I've had for about 2.5 years, I had no idea there was any mind control in her background. All of a sudden, one day, came in and lambasted me from up one side and down the other. She was really angry with me. No real specified reason. I was just in it for the money. I really didn't care about her. I was just like every other bad person in her life, on and on and on and on. And that was when I first began thinking about her, that maybe there was some mind control here. And sure enough, there did turn out to be. So what you want to look for are those kinds of flooding messages or therapist messages in terms of picking up. The other thing you want to do in assessment of a mind control survivor is to look at body pain. There are real specific types of body pain that show up. Headaches, specifically around the temple, that feels like electric shock. Body pains all over the body. Pain in the mouth and the teeth. Pain in the face and the jaw, pain in the ears, or like one of my clients was talking about, always hearing a radio just below the threshold of hearing. And what that is where they put a recorder in the ear. In the right ear, in order to disable, this is a theory, the left brain, they would put pain or a sound. In the left ear, to go into the right brain, which is not reasoning, it's the creative part of you, they would put messages. And they would be whatever, you have to die. One of my clients had this whole elaborate set of ritual abuse instructions of, in the full moon on the third day of September, you have to go and get blood and drink blood and put needles in your arm. And sure enough, we found out cyclically that she was putting pins in her arm at certain times of the year, and there were actual messages. So what you find is that kind of things in your ear, being choked, other kinds of body pain. A lot of these clients have been to doctors, many, many, many doctors, and with exploratory surgeries and other kinds of surgeries that find nothing because some of the symptoms mimic other diseases. And the body pain I have found with the mind control survivors and the SRA survivors is more serious than with people that don't have those kinds of histories. But, so you want to go through the, whether there's pain on the tips of the fingers sometimes, or how are they sleeping tonight, at night? Mind control survivors tend to wake up every 2 hours, or on some schedule of waking up at night, like every hour or every 2 hours. And I'll talk about why that is. So those are the kinds of things that you begin to hear. And then when I begin to hear those kinds of things and some of the symptoms and whatever, one of the questions, and I'll start just asking questions. And one of the questions that I'll ask is, if there were a doctor involved with your abuse and his name were a color, what would that be? Typically what you get is red, black, and then green. And if you get Dr. Green, it's Dr. Green. And every survivor that I've ever talked to will tell you Dr. Green. They may also give you a bunch of other colors. And then at the end, they'll say, okay, green. Or I had one client, the one that came in and lambasted me that day, and I started asking those questions. 6 months later, came into therapy and said, well, all right, I'm ready to talk about it now. It was Dr. Green, and I knew that's who you were asking about, but we weren't ready to deal with it yet. So that's one thing that you can ask. You can also begin to ask more specific, depending on what they're telling you. And the approach that I have used and what I have done is I have really listened to my clients. Really listened to them. They direct the treatment. In the assessment phase, when we're making the contracts at the end of the assessment and we're making contracts about how we are going to work in therapy, my contract with my clients is that they are responsible for their therapy. I don't know specifically, and I do this with everybody, specifically what happened. They have to give me information in order for us to work together. My part of the contract is to make sure that they're safe, to help them design interventions to deal whatever it is, with whatever it is. But it's basically, and to be supportive, and to, and I remember everything that I'm told. I have a really good verbal memory. And so to remember, so that we can make connections to things that otherwise they wouldn't be able to make. And that's my part of it. Their part of it is to talk or draw, because people, not always can people communicate verbally. And if you think of the mind control survivor whose everything is right brain and with DID, people with DID, what you're getting is a lot of right brain communication. They don't tell you directly what's going on. They drop a lot of clues. In fact, one of my clients describes it as the game of Clue. Colonel Mustard did it with the knife in the study. And it really is kind of, with her, that's exactly what it's kind of like, is that I have to kind of help her put it together. So you have a lot of right brain, also a lot of hypnotic trance, communication, which is different from logical conscious communication. Trance logic, A does not go to B, does not go to C, and you have to understand that something you may be being told may not make sense to you, but it does make sense to the person telling you. Okay? But anyway, so my contract is, and I listen, basically my clients tell me what to do. I don't direct the therapy, except to keep them safe. Somebody's cutting or self-mutilating, I jump up and down, and sometimes I get really angry, and we deal with that, and I'll tell you another way of dealing with that that works really well later. But, so anyway, that's if you get nothing else from this. And I hear from people all over the country, and the most common complaint I hear about therapists from people all over the country is, my therapist isn't listening to me. My therapist is telling me that I'm resistant, that I'm uncooperative, that I'm not following the program. Well, that tells me the therapist is directing the treatment. And in the case of mind control and SRA, I firmly believe with all of my clients, they know what they need to do to heal. And I have never been disappointed about that. Okay? And so I listen. And if you get nothing else from this, this is really important. In fact, I was talking to a woman the other day who was looking for a therapist, and what she had done is she'd always gone in logically, left brain, and picked a therapist who was experienced and knew stuff and whatever. And I suggested to her, she's DID, I said, why don't you let your system pick the next therapist? She left me a message and said an hour later, this name floated to the top of her mind, and she went to go, that's the therapist that she felt was really intuitive, and she realized that she'd been picking people with the left brain and she needed someone who could intuitively hear, who was also able to understand right brain communication. Okay? So, you can put the next one. The other thing, and I'm just throwing this up here, but I think it's really important also to do a differential diagnosis. These are some of the typical diagnoses that get attached to our clients. And most of them, the one that I have found that most commonly, or there are a couple in here that get confused and people begin thinking they're sex abuse when there may not be. The most common ones, obsessive compulsive disorder. I'll give you an example of that. I had a woman who came in, I've been seeing her a while, treating her for OCD. She came in and said, oh my God, I had a nightmare last night that my father sexually abused me. Well, there was nothing in her history or behavior to indicate that that was the case. And so we did some very careful, I asked her, what is that connected to in your past? And what she remembered was that when she was 13, she picked up an article in the newspaper, and it was an article about a child being sexually abused. And her thought went to, oh my God, what if my dad does that to me? And started imagining what it would be like. And then her anxiety went way up, and she started ritualizing it, but she never metabolized it. So this thought had been ritualized, and every time it came up or she got triggered, she would start ritualizing against this imaginary, and it really was imaginary. And what ended up happening is when she realized she'd read the article and what happened, then the anxiety went down and she realized that she had not been sexually abused. So I think a really good differential diagnosis is good. Borderline personality disorder, I consider to be a perfect description of survivor behavior. If you look in the DSM, what you will see is everything that we talk about is characteristics of sexual abuse, if there is such a thing. But it really, to me, it seems like, and when I treat it like that, it's much easier. I don't get frustrated with all this, quote, borderline behavior. Yes?
Just a real simple explanation of most of these things.
Okay. Paranoid is when you think people are out to get you. Schizoid means that you absolutely do not react to anything that could be a dissociative response. Schizotypal is another type of disorder where you don't react to stuff, you don't have relationships, not a lot of feeling. Antisocial is the people that commit crimes, who have very little feeling or affect, and basically are out for their own good. Borderline, as I said, are people that have shallow, frequent move from relationship to relationship, have very intense relationships. They'll have an intense relationship with the therapist, but really fear intimacy. Histrionic is someone who is hysterical and always emoting all over the place, but again, that can be a dissociative response. Narcissistic. Let me just say a word about narcissistic. What I have found is a lot of survivors look very narcissistic, and that means very self-centered and everything for them. I had one client who every time she went to see her psychiatrist, after a while the psychiatrist said to me, "Where the hell are you in this therapy?" And what was happening was that she would go in and tell him all these things that she was doing in therapy. Now, I was working my butt off. She was mind control. But it was like I didn't exist. And she came across as extremely narcissistic. When we got to the bottom of this, what it turned out was, she had a lot of suicidal programming and a lot of body pain, is that she was so focused on her survival and what she needed to do to stay alive. She had no energy or room for focusing on others. And that happens with our clients. Now that she's through the process, she's not narcissistic at all. Okay? So what I also caution people about is if you're looking at narcissistic behavior, check to see if maybe there's a deep-rooted fear, survival thing going on there. Because if people are surviving, you better believe they're narcissistic, because that's all that exists if it's basic survival. Avoidant is avoiding people. Dependent is dependent on others, not being able to make decisions. This could be one of the things that you see with mind control. A lot of my clients very dependent on their perpetrators still, or dependent on other people in their lives, can't imagine making decisions on their own. And a large part of the treatment process is teaching people that they have choices. Okay? A large part of that, and that they can make decisions, but they'll fight you on it. Obsessive compulsive is when people do rituals, or they like the hand washing, but it can be more subtle than that, counting in your head. Now, I have a mind control survivor who counts in her head who's not obsessive compulsive. It's a memory. Okay, they made her count backwards or count forwards every time they put her in trance. So whenever she switches, she counts forwards or backwards.